Hi.
You know how it goes. You're walking down the hallway or the sidewalk, not looking where you're going, and suddenly you bump into the arms of a stranger. Bags and papers fall to the ground. You both reach down at the same time, look into each other's eyes. What? You mean that's never happened to you? Today in Studio 360, we're feeling the love. We'll meet a Hollywood screenwriter who'll do your dating for you online. And one lucky listener out there will get an original love song custom-made by a balladeer for hire.
It's a frightening experience to write about other people's relationships, and that's part of the reason that I started doing it.
'Cause our summer of love never ended.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That's all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of PRI's Studio 360, where each week, Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. Studio 360 can be heard on public radio stations across America. Please help support the show by becoming a member of your local station. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
You're still the one I love.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Yeah, looks like we made it.
So it's Valentine's Day, and notwithstanding the cheesy commercialism, you still probably want to do something romantic for your sweetheart. Maybe something musical, but if you're like me, you can't play or sing a lick. So you could make a mix CD, or you could do a John Cusack from Say Anything, where he stands under the girl's window serenading her with a boombox.
All my instincts, they return.
Okay, maybe not. But what if you could have an actually talented professional musician write a song just for your special loved one, not a string of generic cliches, something that really captures your particular love story? This is where the musician Corey Dargle comes in.
I went to his website, and I noticed on there that he had this thing he was doing where he was writing love songs. He was being commissioned to write love songs. And I just thought, what a great idea.
Yeah.
What a wonderful gift.
That's Jeff Marshall, a lawyer from Pennsylvania, who really wanted to do something special for his wife's 60th birthday.
So I didn't tell my wife right then, but I contacted him by email, and that's how we got started on this.
So Corey Dargle asked Jeff to tell him the story of how he and his wife met back in 1967.
We met at a mixer between Stanford Law School and Mills College. So she was sitting with a group of girls playing cards, and I walked up and said I wanted to cut her for a dance. And she has this gorgeous long black hair and down her waist and was very exotic, from Honolulu, and I was from the backwoods of Pennsylvania. So, we ended up going upstairs in my dorm room to talk. We were, you know, we were adults, and the walls of the room were blank. And I told her that that was kind of like my life, waiting to be filled in. My life was a blank wall.
And she was the 15th girl you'd said that to, I guess.
No, actually, that wasn't true. I was feeling very blank, I guess, that day.
The musician that Jeff hired, Corey Dargle, is here with me right now. Corey, welcome.
Thank you.
I would love it if you would play that song that you wrote for Jeff and his wife.
I'd be happy to. It's called Summer of Love.
Great.
It was 1967. The summer of love was upon us. The Doors and Jefferson Airplane. Excellent sex and decent marijuana. Remember that night in Crothers Hall when you noticed the walls
walls of my dorm room were empty. I said they were waiting to be filled by the life that we'd built. And we've done pretty well, haven't we? They say you can no longer find any romantic men at Stanford Law School. Falling in love is not recommended. And they've even stopped bussing the Mills girls in. It's a good thing we left when we did. 'Cause our summer of love never ended. I'd have been the worst workaholic if you hadn't been my bride. But here we are in our bucolic home, with the Appalachian Mountains just outside. Remember the first movie we ever saw? It was Valley of the Dolls. And the way you stroked my arm so sweetly. My heart was yours. My heart was yours completely. They say you can no longer find any romantic men at Stanford Law School. Falling in love is not recommended. And they've even stopped bussing the Mills girls in. It's a good thing we left when we did. 'Cause our summer of love never ended.
That was Corey Dargle with Jim Altieri on violin. That is so lovely.
Thank you.
So you make records, you perform, you have a career. What made you take on this project?
I've always thought of my songs as first and foremost recordings that are listened to by one person at a time. And to me, this seemed like the next natural step for that, to write songs about specific individuals one at a time and to make those songs special for them.
Do you always take sort of direct lines from the stories that they tell you?
I do, yeah, actually most of the time. But the songs are mine, so I can't take everything. But there are little hints of things that people say, as you heard from Jeff's story, that comes into this song. But the trick is to make it a formal lyric, you know, to find the rhyme scheme, to find the patterns, and try and make it a little unusual as well.
Are some people, when you talk to them, more naturally poetic, or better collaborators?
In my experience, people are actually more intimidated by the interview process than I expect them to be. It's difficult to talk to a stranger about a relationship that's very important to you that stranger has no idea about.
You're not even their shrink.
Maybe I could be. Maybe I could get a little extra.
Have there been stories that have surprised you?
Well, the most surprising thing and the most challenging thing for me so far was a commission from a woman who at first didn't tell me who she wanted the song to be for. And when she told me, I was surprised because she wanted to commission a song for a baby that she had miscarried. And for me, as a man, not having the ability to experience anything like that, I was very concerned and wary of doing that. But we ended up working on it together, and it ended up being really one of my favorite songs.
Have you ever turned down anybody altogether after you hear their story?
No, not yet.
So, put you on the spot. Could you write a song for me and my wife, do you think?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Cool. What do I need to tell you?
Well, what's her name?
Her name is Anne.
Well,
And her name is Anne Kramer. She doesn't share my last name.
Why don't you tell me about your first date?
It was the datiest date in history, perhaps. It was a blind date, and my first and last blind date. Went to see weird, dissonant, modern composer played by an orchestra in Carnegie Hall. Went out to dinner. Went to play pinball back in the day when pinball existed. And it
was pinball is pretty dissonant, too.
Well, there you go. then went to a disco because this was 1977.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did all those things, and that was our first date. Yeah, that was how we met.
Well, I would also ask you, what kind of routine things do you do together?
We both write at home. We're both writers and have been for the last 5 or 6 or 7 years when she changed careers to become a writer. And so now we work at home together and then sort of like the mom and pop in the mom and pop store come down and have lunch together every day, which is mm-hmm. a kind of delightful new ritual. You know, and we've been we have two children and have been kind of antiquely committed from the time they were little to having dinner together as a family in an old-fashioned way.
Mm-hmm.
And we still do that. And of course, now as they're starting to leave home, I worry about that first year or two when they're gone, or first month or two when they're both gone, and like, okay, honey, what are we talking about now? But my evil younger child, who's a junior in high school, often, every third dinner, sort of teases us and says, okay, this is fine. I've been talking to you, but when I'm not here, what are you going to do? And so she knows just how to get to our soft, sore spot.
Well, you talk a lot in your job, and you write a lot. But do you find that you run out of things to talk about as a couple?
No, we don't. We don't. We've never had that classic horrible moment.
Well, I think that's good for
cool.
me.
And if we need to talk more later, we can.
Yeah,
or email or something. Great. Well, we're going to offer our listeners a chance to win a song from you. If you want your very own Corey Dargle tune written about your loved one, go to studio360.org. Tell us what you'd want your song to be about with details and why in 300 words or less. We'll pick our favorite story and commission Corey to write a song based on it. Coming up, a very, very different kind of Valentine. That is just ahead in Studio 360.
Like a vulture in the sky.
From PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. You know how people fall in love? In the movies, I mean. You really can't make a romantic comedy without a scene near the beginning that screenwriters call the meet cute. Here's how it works.
Serendipity. It's one of my favorite words.
Mm-hmm.
It's just such a nice sound for what it means, a fortunate accident.
I'm so sorry. Here.
Get your hands off.
I'm really sorry.
Except I don't really believe in accidents. I think fate's behind everything.
No, you do.
Yeah.
We've got to stop meeting like this.
I think you're making a mistake. You see, I just came in here for something, for a headache.
And then I saw you. And I was saved.
Uh-huh.
I hope.
Was it something I said?
No, I get these headaches. Do you speak English?
Have you been getting results with a line like that? Or would I be surprised?
Miss, I think you're making a mistake.
Sure, that's all I am to you, a mistake. Clerical error. Erase me. Forget you even know my name.
I don't know your name.
What is your name?
I didn't get your name.
No, I didn't give it to you.
That sounds like a nasty crack. Well, I could make a few, too, if I wanted
sure
to.
Sure, you could.
Oh, I know I can.
That's what I said.
All right, I think I will.
This is just like in the movies, remember? And the lady vanishes when she says to him, you're the most obnoxious man I ever met.
The most contemptible.
Then they fall madly in love.
Of course, in real life, you don't happen to share a ride with Meg Ryan and then get married. If you want to fall in love, you probably go online these days, and you pray that among the tens of millions of people looking for dates, your profile will stand out. That is where Hollywood now comes back into play. Evan Katz is a screenwriter, but he's turned his talent for creating plausible, lovable characters into a business, helping real people get real dates. Evan calls his service E-Cyrano, as in Cyrano de Bergerac. Lori Gottlieb has the story.
Leslie Shadham had a problem with her online dating profile.
My best friend who's helping me with this describes me as good-looking, fun-loving, creative, loyal, supportive, well-read, dedicated to friends and family. Long, shiny black hair, fair skin, golden brown eyes.
An attractive 46-year-old living in Santa Monica, Leslie got plenty of responses, but not from men she connected with. Evan Katz, who runs E-Cyrano, knew why. Her profile was too generic.
Most people give you a laundry list of adjectives when it comes to describing themselves. I am this, or I am looking for someone who is nice and smart and warm and kind and funny and honest and successful and ambitious and family-oriented. And as a result, everybody kind of sounds the same.
Well, I wrote that I like to cook. Gee, do you know any women that like to cook? Evan wrote about how the signature dessert at my home is this bittersweet chocolate souffle.
Everybody kind of has the answers inside of them. So it's a matter of asking people questions that they might not know to ask themselves.
I think very rarely we do writing like this. I mean, I write business reports. So you take the I out of something like that. You don't wax lyrical about all the fun things that you do.
Leslie also had to learn the peculiar diction of the opposite sex.
I have what I would call kind of an hourglass figure. And I had used some analogies of curvy or voluptuous. He's like, no. Men interpret that as I'm trying to lose the last 10 or 15 pounds.
Writing in a woman's voice comes naturally to Evan, maybe because he spent years listening to his sister talk about dating. One of his trickiest clients to mimic was Israel Gvozda, a 44-year-old emigre.
I needed someone who makes sure that his English is correct. But it looks like it's a contradicting goal. From the other side, I want to make sure that people see me.
He went in and changed it, so it reads in more broken English than what I gave him. He actually worsened the grammar in his own profile once he put it up on JDate.
Do you want me to read the whole thing? Wow. I'm from Israel, but I've been living in the United States for 14 years, and at this point, I feel here at home. For me, here is a very important part of the whole sentence. That's my put in the middle. I feel here at home.
Evan's used to being rewritten. After all, he worked in Hollywood. But moonlighting as E-Cyrano is a very different challenge than writing screenplays.
When you're a screenwriter, although you could say, well, I have the freedom to create whatever I want, there's also a certain burden in creating someone who is believable, likable, flawed, all those kind of things. When you're interviewing someone for an hour and asking them some tough questions, who they are, what they're looking for, they're giving you everything that you need. You don't really create a character. You just capture the character.
Still, sometimes it's best not to capture the entire character.
Everything I write is real, so I can't just say, oh, I'm going to make you fascinated by this, or an expert in this, or a lover of this. But if leaving out some of the negative truth is fiction, you know, define it as you will.
I'd like to think it's the me that you would definitely experience, but on a good day. So if you're thinking about making a first impression on someone, we ideally want it to all be one of our better days. Although, I think if you're looking for true love, it's the person that really connects with you on one of the bad days. That's love.
It's very clear.
For Studio 360, I'm Lori Gottlieb.
Our love is here to stay. Not for a year.
We can hook you up with E-Cyrano. Just go to our website, studio360.org.
The radio and the telephone and the movies that we know, they're all just passing fancy.
But let's say you'd rather write your own dating profile the old-fashioned way and maybe your own piece of love poetry to go with it. In that case, you could enlist the help of Susan House. She teaches poetry to adults on Chicago's North Side. Her class is usually a pretty subdued affair, but one day, a former gang member named Cifredo Torres showed up. He locked eyes with another student, Diana Giraldo, And like in the movies, sparks flew. Here's how their teacher, Susan House, remembers it.
We didn't notice that they were writing to each other at first. So we were critiquing it like poems, without, then we were totally oblivious to the fact that there was deeper communication going on here.
There's much beauty, okay. There's much beauty on this earth, in stalling trees and cloudful sky, but the greatest beauty is you in my heart. Because
the poems were very syrupy. Sometimes it's like wading through molasses. Siffredo used the phrase soaring above the clouds in beauty, and he kept using it. Every poem, sometimes sunshine was added to it, and sometimes a bird or a flower would flutter through, but he was always above the clouds, in beauty. And she picked it up. And then it was like a ping pong game where just that phrase kept batting back and forth between them.
In your eyes, I see the beauty in our love. And I will always see that our beauty for our love for each other will be more than what we want. And I see our love in your face.
I regularly had to roll my eyes and say, let's write about something besides love. So then they started finding other ways to express themselves. Each week, the writing group, I give a word or a phrase or two. And so I told Siffredo, you have to use these words. You have to write about something other than this soaring above the clouds mess that you do. And so one week, the phrase was chair. And I said, you must write about the chair.
I love you, my chair, my sweet. Your legs are so strong and thick. You hold my weight. I touch you. You excite me.
So he wrote a love poem to the chair, which I really learned, let him write what he needs to write.
Your beauty gives me a burning desire, and I cannot wait to sit down again.
She went to Mexico in the summer for a month with her mother, and when she came back, we asked her to write about her trip. Now, she was born and raised in Chicago, so Mexican food is a problem for her. And we were all interested in why didn't she like the food in Mexico? What was different? And so we had her write about it.
In Mexico, some people like to eat food with a lot of hot peppers, and I like food with only a few hot peppers. When I came back home, my father was happy to see me.
So she had this little summary of the food in the beginning of her story, and then went immediately to, when she got home, she called Siffredo.
When he came to my house, he was happy to see me, and I was very happy when I saw him. And when I saw him, I cried, and I gave him a big kiss.
She could not help herself. She just cried. And everybody was a little teary-eyed, It was like, great, they're together again. They survived this awful vacation. I know that their perfect attendance has something to do with them being able to see each other here. They can't date because he can't just go out at will. He's on probation and he doesn't have the privilege of traveling wherever he wants to go. He has permission to go to school, to go to his group meetings, to go to his job, and that's it. So this is where they see each other. This is their relationship. This is where it happens. One evening, as people were coming in and signing in and getting settled down, people do gather around right outside of my cubicle in the evening. It's where the sign-in book is. It's a social time, and they came together, and they looked like a pair of cats that had eaten somebody's canary. They were just full of something. And then he got the little box out, and he didn't read her a poem. He was very formal and just told her he loved her and asked for her hand in marriage. And of course, all their students and the tutors were standing around watching this. People just froze and watched. And she accepted, burst into tears, and he put the ring on her hand. I think I was stunned. This is not what I normally see in an adult ed program. Normally, we're very grim, We try not to be, but people have goals. Maybe they're going to lose their job if they can't get certification or whatever. It's a place where people try to make up for things they've lost in their lives, It's hardly ever a place where just pure joy blooms. And people come here not just focused on themselves, but to enjoy Diane and Siffredo, and to be a small part of this big thing. as a teacher, anything that makes them write is good, you know. And their writing's improving, so what else could I ask for? With the help of the group saying, you know, find another way to say this. You don't have to repeat the word love 78 times in a 15-line poem, you know. It's a little more sophisticated, and it's changing. Diana wrote one where she just, in the course of the poem, shares the smell in the air of a room with him. It's a world away in sophistication from her first poem to him.
I'll never forget that empty barn, smell of dry hay, those long columns of dusty light. For one whole minute, you and I breathe the same breath.
That story was produced by Amy Dorn and Alex Kotlowitz. As we know, love isn't all sweetness and light. In fact, it can sometimes get ugly. But there are love songs for that, too. Next week, the singer and avant-garde composer Diamanda Galás will perform an evening-length suite called Diamanda's Valentine's Day Massacre at a club in New York.
I refer to it as the Valentine's Day Massacre because I refer to it as songs that were sung by a person who woke up and looked at her lover and said, ah, what a huge mistake this was.
The concert is billed as a, quote, spellbinding night of tragic and homicidal love songs. And this is coming from a singer who once did a song called Wild Women with Steak Knives.
I see it as this. The woman sees an object, a man. Let's say she's the spider, that's the insect. She sees it. She loves it. She becomes fascinated by it. She stares at it for a really very long time. At some point, she wants to eat it.
I put a spell on you because you're mine.
I don't know anything about if you love something, set it free. I think I know something about if you love something, hunt it down, and then if you have to, kill it, you know. I mean, but that's when it's no longer yours. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, since I don't have the bank account to be able to kill something that no longer loves me, I have to figure out other means of coping with that.
I can't stand it, don't put me down. I don't care if you don't want me, 'cause I'm young and I'm in a spell.
That song's real interesting because that song focuses on the words, I don't care if you don't want me because I'm yours anyhow. And that's a real stalker kind of expression. It's kind of like, look, you know, it's over now. What your opinion is or where you want to go with this relationship is really irrelevant. Where I want to go is what's relevant. So you better watch and lock your door because I'm in there for the duration. And I had had a relationship with someone like that, and his voice appears on all night. I put a spell on you, threatening me, actually, on my answering machine. And I say that with a laugh because he's a hilarious character. But I mean, I had to stop seeing him. I mean, I had to stop talking to him altogether because he threatened me so many times. All I was singing for quite a long time were, in fact, homicidal love songs or death songs. I was never singing songs about the process of being in love or this sort of thing, which I couldn't even imagine doing.
Baby's insane. Baby's on a trip to the moon again.
Ava Gardner and Frank Sinatra, I always enjoy that relationship, you know, where there was all this fighting and then they would get back together again and they would fight again and they would get back together again. And that I think is a very beautiful way I would think about some of these songs. I'd even do the song All the Way, which Frank Sinatra sang. I believe he sang that after Ava Gardner left him and went to Spain. I think so. I think that that's what I'm portraying in the songs, you know, because there's never a sense of stability.
The falling leaves drift by my window. The autumn leaves let it go.
One of the things that happened, it was more or less a year ago, was that my parents were both in very, very ill and hospitalized, and a lot of the old songs that they loved, that were romantic songs, very romantic songs, suddenly had a lot of meaning to me, because I would see them in the hospital holding hands and looking out the window together at nighttime, and I would say, this is something, these people growing old together and after all these years, and the only thing they look forward to at the end of the day is holding hands and watching the sunset in this horrible place. I take the song where I feel the song is for me, I mean, and reflects my personality, which is unfortunate. It's an unfortunate personality as concerns subjects like love, because I'm not an easy person to know, and so anyone who gets to know me has a very big job. That's the way it goes.
Put a spell on you.
Amanda Galas performs her Valentine's Day Massacre at the Knitting Factory in New York City next week, and you can watch a sneak preview of her singing I Put a Spell on You at studio360.org. Earlier in the hour, we heard from the singer-songwriter Corey Dargle, and he is back now to play one more song for us. Corey, what's it going to be?
This is a song called I Don't Remember from my album called Less Famous Than You. And it's a song that before I officially launched the Commission a Love Song project, this was a song written for a friend of mine whose mother at the time was in the beginning stages of Alzheimer's. And I think that's all I need to say about it.
Let's hear it.
Sometimes I pick up the phone and try to think of your number, but I never write things down, and I'm not getting I may have been in love at some point, but I don't remember. I lose my memory faster than I lose my temper. If I've forgotten your name or the sound of your voice, it's not that I'm a bad person. I was never good with faces. Everyone looks the same, and there's too much noise, and I've got an aversion to loud and crowded places. I used to love karaoke. I used to go out dancing, but these days I don't dance, and I can't sing. I can't remember the words, and when I do, they come out wrong. So if you know the next verse, it would help if you could sing along.
That was Corey Dargle with Jim Altieri on violin. Corey, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Kurt.
If you'd like Corey Dargle to write your love song for a parent or a child, friend, spouse, whomever, go to studio360.org and tell us who, what, and why. We'll give the listener with the best story a free commission from Corey, and then he'll come back on the show to perform the song. Coming up, we hear from a young Sudanese man who escaped the endless war in his country and became the hero of Dave Eggers' new novel.
One thing about the books, what seems to be unrealistic are the things that really happened.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. In 2000, the writer Dave Eggers became a literary superstar with his memoir, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. It was an unusual hybrid of personal history and fiction, comic and tragic, about raising his younger brother after the sudden death of their parents. Dave's most recent book is also memoir, and it is full of truly heartbreaking horrors. But it's not about his life. It's the story of Valentino Achak Dang, a young refugee from Sudan. Valentino was separated from his family by the civil war there. He escaped his village on foot and, after wandering for years, ultimately found his way to the United States. But Valentino's struggles only continued once he got here. The book is called What is the What? And parts of the story are fictionalized by Eggers. But most of it, including some of the most disturbing events, is entirely true. Both the author and the subject are here with me today. Dave, Valentino, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kurt.
So, Dave, this is Valentino's harrowing life story. How come you wrote it as a novelized version?
Well, we met almost 4 years ago in Atlanta, and there was a woman named Mary Williams who headed up the Lost Boys Foundation, which was a group that was helping with the resettlement of Sudanese refugees. And so she wrote to me one day saying that there was a young man that was interested in writing his autobiography or a biography. He wanted to tell his story, and would I be interested in helping? So I flew out to Atlanta just to meet with Valentino and see how I could help, and that began a very long journey of trying to bring his story into a book form.
Now, most of the stuff in this book is presumably true. For instance, when lions suddenly come out and grab one of your companions and take him away, that happened?
It did. One thing about the books, what seems to be unrealistic are the things that really happened. See, when they say the lion grabbed someone, that's true. When they said somebody was shot into the water swimming, that's true. When they say the soldiers called the kids and shot on them after they gave them food, that is true. And you will realize that in the book that most of the things that seems unacceptable are the things that has indeed happened.
So it's the mundane things that are fictional.
Yes.
That's true. We actually cut back on the actual events. There's nothing in the book that could not have happened during that time. I wanted to, for example, very slowly lay out what it was like in Mario Bay, Valentino's home village, before the war. And that's something that Valentino, it was harder to do that back and forth. I sort of had to take everything I knew and take a lot from when we went back to Sudan in 2003.
You went back together?
Yeah, we went back in shortly, about 8 months after we met, something like that. And it was a ceasefire, but it was before the peace agreement down there, so we weren't supposed to go, but we made it back to his home village, and then that I was able to sort of envision what it was like and what it would have been like before the war.
So, Valentino, now when you look back on that 15-year period, are there certain moments where you think, my God, I can't believe that happened to me?
There are movements. For example, there is situations where somebody was dying and I had to bypass them, and they are asking me for help. They needed water, they needed food, but I didn't have any. See, movement like that, flashback. And then there's time I would be like, here was me being fired a phone by the government soldiers, or the government dropped a bomb and I didn't get killed. Why did that happen? And I would say, I was not unique. I was not so special than anyone who died, but maybe there was a purpose. And purpose is anything like the book we have written, and that will tell details, information of what happened in Sudan.
Dave, could you read some of the book, a passage?
Yeah. This is a passage. I'd been interviewing Valentino for probably two and a half years. When one day when he was visiting, I don't know how it started, but I might have asked a question like, in Kakuma or in either refugee camp, did you ever have an interest in girls? You were an adolescent, you know? And I think that we think, well, they're living on one meal a day, you know, as they were in Kakuma, and they're worried about being recruited as soldiers. Why would they have time for girls? But of course, Val starts talking about these four girls that he knew in Pinudo that they nicknamed the Royal Girls because they were very special. And he's been trying to impress them all semester long by being basically the teacher's pet. And the teacher is the uncle to these four girls. So everybody knows who they are. Everybody covets these girls. But at the same time, they're afraid of doing anything to upset the teacher lest they be caned after school. So here's this is when he finally has some success with the girls. It took the entire semester, but finally my efforts toward the Royal Girls bore fruit. With 1 week left before classes let out for a month, as I was leaving school one day, a gum positioned herself in front of me and said something. It was as likely as a zebra appearing before me and whistling. What had she said? I had to piece the words together. It was all so sudden, the changing of one life into another. I was so jarred I heard nothing. I had been looking at her eyes, her lashes, her mouth that was so close to mine. Ashak, my sister has something to ask you, she had said. Agar, the eldest and tallest, was suddenly next to her. Her sister stomped on her foot and was punched in return. I didn't know what was happening, but it seemed good so far. Do you want to come to lunch at our house? Agar asked. I realized at that moment that I had been standing on my tiptoes. I righted myself, hoping that they had not noticed. Today? I asked. Yes, today, they said. I thought a moment. I thought long enough to think of the wrong thing to say. I cannot accept, I said. I could not believe I said that. Can you believe this is what I said? I had refused the royal nieces of Pinudo. Why? Because I had been taught that a gentleman refuses invitations. The lesson had been explained by my father one warm night as I was helping him close his shop, but the context was not applicable. I would later learn. Now, Val, you want to explain what that advice was, that you have to say no to the girls that are asking you to lunch?
The advice was, you know, my father one time told me that when a girl asks you out, you know, be a gentleman by refusing the offer at least first or second times, and then accept it on the third time. attempt. And when I tried this, I realized that I had just screwed up a chance that I have worked for the last semester. And I was like, I should review some of my father's teaching. They're not going to work here. That was what happened.
It's lovely to come across this sweet coming-of-age story in the middle of this hellish war. But once you get out of Sudan and come to America and settle in Atlanta, you had a terribly traumatic experience. What happened?
I had just come back from my school, and I found a vent, a black vent, outside our parking area. And I saw people inside but didn't pay attention, and I went to my room. And I opened my apartment just to let the hot air out and turn on the cooler system. And the lady came out, the woman came out from the car and said, "Hey, could I use your cell phone? I want to call my sister, and I don't have a phone." And I said, "Okay, just here, take it." The moment I gave her my cell phone, she went straight into my room, and I said, "You can make a call outside here. You don't have to be inside my room." And she proceeded to my bedroom and locked herself in my bedroom. And I was knocked the door, and I said, "Why? That can happen." By the time I didn't even finish that statement, there were two guys already. And they were like, "Hey, Africa, what are you doing? What do you think you're doing?" And I said, "What are you doing in my room? Do you know this woman?" And they said, "Yeah, but do you know us? We're going to teach you a lesson." And it became obvious to me that I am under attack and I had to do something maybe to get out. I tried to get out, to leave them in my room. They wouldn't let me go. And one of them pulled a laptop, my roommate's laptop, together and was taking it. And I tried to stop, and that's how they started beating me. And I started to struggle by pushing one of them, but already a pistol was removed and put in my head.
You finally get out of that, but did you think, as I would have, geez, I survived 15 years of attacks and nightmare and horror in Africa, East Africa, and here I come here, and it's not the perfect America that I'd hoped for?
I never thought about that, but like it would at any place, there are incidences like that. Crimes happen anywhere, and maybe these people didn't even know my background. If I would sit down with them and tell them what happened in detail to me, I think they will walk away. But at that point, I was their target. They were looking for something, maybe computers, maybe money, and I was their potential target. And it's interesting. Michael in the book is one of them that I'm telling this story to.
Dave, your first book was a memoir about losing your parents and raising your little brother. This book is a memoir about a man who's been violently separated from his family. Were you thinking about a connection between your life and his?
I think that the weird thing is that Valentino's parents are alive. We thought at first we were both orphans, you know, but Valentino's parents we met in Mar-el-Bai, and they're alive and doing pretty well.
You didn't know that until 3 years ago, that your parents were alive?
It took me very long to know that, because the entire communication was cut. You don't know who was alive in your family and who is not, except if you happen to witness a member of your family die on the spot and you left. So that gap, you know, gave me a feeling that my family wasn't alive, and it was a miracle that they survived the atrocities in Sudan. They didn't go anywhere. They spent the 16 years that we were separated, you know, running from place to place and coming back to Mar-el-Bai when the attack aren't there. And when we went to meet them, they weren't the same parent I knew. A lot of things had changed, which frustrated me a little bit. If I compare the picture of my dad right before I left him with the picture that I went and took when we went, there's a great difference. Hmm. Yeah, but it was exciting to meet them again.
Valentino, Dave, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What is the What has been nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award. The winners will be announced in March. I'm Kurt Anderson. Thanks for listening to Studio 360 today. I hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Rob Weisberg,
Sarah Lilly,
Joseph McCannon,
Brendan Baker,
Brooke Schumann.
And thanks to Jonathan Mitchell for producing our piece on the Hollywood Meet Cute. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, supporting CARE in its efforts to alleviate global poverty, on the web at care.org, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's series on underground heroes is supported in part by the New York State Music Fund, established by the New York State Attorney General at Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors.
PRI, Public Radio International.
He's 19 feet tall, marble, and kind of homely.
Lincoln is not the most classically beautiful face. You know, he was held in such esteem, but Lincoln is such a screwy-looking guy.
Join me and Sarah Vowell to figure out how the Lincoln Memorial became an American icon. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to PRI's Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. You can find out more about this episode and access our entire program archive at studio360.org. Thanks.